Welcome to the Dublin Festival of History podcast. In this episode, Ireland, the autobiography, eyewitness accounts of Irish life since 1916, John Bowman discusses his new book on Irish history with moderator Patrick Gagan. Recorded at Printworks Dublin Castle on the 25th of September 2016.
Well, good afternoon. You are very welcome to this event. The format is we're going to hear from the author for about 10-15 minutes, then I'll be interviewing him, and then we'll move on to some questions from the floor. So it's one of those cliches when people say that the speaker needs no introduction, and then they go on and give the introduction. But John Bowman is, I think it's fair to say, one of Ireland's most loved broadcasters. He's also an award-winning historian. For 21 years, he presented and chaired the Brilliant Questions and Answers, and he continues to present various history and current affairs programmes on television and on radio. I was impressed to learn that he's actually interviewed every single Taoiseach going back to Sean Lemass, and he always makes our election coverage much more interesting and entertaining. His new book is Ireland, an Anthology, and as it says on the cover, it's it's an anthology collection. It's, as it says on the cover, it's 100 years in the life of the nation told by its people, and it's published in hardback by Penguin Ireland. You can get it for a reduced price outside for €23. It's currently number 6 in the Irish non-fiction hardback charts. And it was reviewed by Professor Diarmaid Farrator in the Irish Times yesterday, and he called it absorbing and illuminating, and it is certainly that. And there's great pieces in it, as we'll see. There are some pieces that make you think about how much Ireland has changed over the past 100 years. There are some pieces that make you laugh, because you can't even imagine that things like that were being said and written 80, 90, 100 years ago. It's something that makes you stop, to pause, to think, to reflect, as all good books do. It also leads you to think about how you might have selected pieces for it and what would have made your anthology of Irish history over the past 100 years. And I think that's part of the fun of reading it as well. But I think that's as much as I'll give as an introduction, and now I'll hand you over to the person who we're all here to see and to hear, John Bowman.
Thank you, Patrick, for that introduction, and I see a few faces in the audience who will have heard this opening comment before, but I'll share it with you anyway, because I'm really enthused by the size of this audience, and not least given the fact that the word cancelled wasn't used, but anyway, when we were all out in the rain trying to come in here, somebody said that it's called off until the fire alarm is over anyway. So I asked them to say, would you please say postponed? So thank you for waiting, and thank you for being here. But just before that, the audience is so large that I'm really enthused, because many years ago I was invited by the history master at my daughter's school to talk to the parents about the decline of history at second level, which of course is a challenge. And I said, well, that's fine, I'd love to do that, but unfortunately, but will the said decline not reflect itself in small numbers coming up to hear me? So he said, look, leave the publicity to me, you get on with the paper. So that I did. And on that night in South Dublin, there was flash flooding, and you couldn't be other than drowned between your hall door and the car and then getting out here. When I arrived at the school, my wife had told me, nobody's going to turn up to listen to you tonight, droning on about history and second level and so on. So anyway, when I got to the school, I was more than delighted, because the car park was full, and there were mainly younger mothers all jumping out to rush in to hear me, and I was very pleased. What I didn't know is that there was a special masterclass in stretch marks, what to do after the baby, and another masterclass in bust line before the summer, again what to do after breastfeeding, and a third in cellulite. I thought only French women were worried about cellulite, or that it only existed in France, because you can't pass a pharmacist in France without a photograph of cellulite and all sorts of solutions. But anyway, I was sometime later at the World Conference of Psychiatrists in Paris, where I was the number 2. I was the spouse and my wife was there. And I was telling this story about, because I should have told you, I had an audience of three. I needed to say that. So anything over three ever since is terrific. But I was telling this psychiatrist who, now the plenary session, it was in the Sorbonne, and there were 2,000 people, 2,000 psychiatrists from around the world, all listening to the opening session. Then they went off to separate rooms. And this particular Irishman was there, and he could see his name in lights in the Irish Journal of Psychiatry, paper read to the World Conference and whatever it was. He was in room B12, and he said, well, I went to room B12, and he said, I had an audience of one. And when he finished his paper and went down to thank the audience for being there, the chap said to him, don't go now, I'm on next. So... you should. So it's terrific to see such a large, interested audience in this conference, and I thank Bert for arranging all of that. Now, this anthology, I did a book a few years ago on the history of RTE television, and it had to be written very, very fast because there was a deadline, which was the known 50th anniversary, so there was no question of delays. And I was exhausted after it. So I thought I would turn my hand to something that would be simpler. And I can tell you, an anthology of this kind is not simple because the choices, there are so many choices to be made. And 170 documents illustrating the Irish life since 1916. And there are many, many ways of doing this. And this is just the way I did it. That's all it can be. It can't be anything other than that, and other people will see omissions, and that's fine. That's the book they would have done. There are always reasons of an incremental kind why you leave something in or out, or why you make final decisions about what may seem like a less important document than another. But I reckon that it can tell the comprehensive history, of course, but it's for those, it should be of interest to those who know the story of Ireland and those who think they know the story and those who don't know the story. It's particularly relevant, I think, to the latter, who cannot yet face, and I, of course, would hope that reading a book like this or dipping in and going through a book like this would introduce people to the many excellent surveys there are, sometimes covering parts of that same time period, sometimes going a bit longer, but there are books, as you know, by Joe Lee, by Alvin Jackson, by Dermot Ferreter, by many, many authors, Roy Foster, and many, many authors, Paul Bew. There would be probably 20 survey histories of Ireland, which are absolutely first rate and very challenging. And sometimes people who don't read history that much might start, if they start with this book, which is kind of easy to read because of the nature of the book, 170 documents, that might prompt them, and I hope it would prompt them to then read a survey history which would capture the total story with the duty for the writer to be comprehensive. So each document stands alone and it's put in context. You can browse, skip and read, and it's full of surprises, I hope. And writing it, I learned much more than I thought I was going to, because I thought, in a way, I didn't have a lot to learn about Ireland since 1916, because I thought I knew the story, and of course I sort of do. But I've been known as somebody interested in current affairs and in politics, and in sort of high politics, if you like, but I've never believed that it's the duty of a historian to forget many of the other aspects of life, because, you know, it just is not the story. And so social life, women's role, culture, dancing, sexual relations, how boy meets girl, or didn't, or couldn't, or wouldn't, or was told he shouldn't. That is very much a recurring theme in the book. It just keeps coming in, particularly up to the 1950s. I mean, Ireland was an extraordinary, extraordinary place. I'll just read you one piece, for instance, by James Kavanagh. And it's from The Bell. John Kavanagh, sorry. It's called Puritanism in Rural Ireland. And he compares the sort of the boy meets girl, the dancing of the 1930s with the late 40s and the changes that happened because of the sort of rise of Puritanism and the impact of the parish priest who was trying to control everything. One day I went to confession. The priest asked me if I kept company with a girl. Yes, Father. Do you kiss her? Yes. How often? 50 times, 2 nights a week. How long has this been going on? About 2 years. Did you ever tell it in confession before? No, Father. Why? I didn't think it was a sin. Will you promise me now not to meet this girl alone again? I won't, Father. Why? Because I'd break my promise tomorrow night. Get out of this box. You're damned. I got up and went out, but he called me back. Do you intend to marry this girl? I don't know. Why don't you know? I'm not in a position to get married. Then when will you be in a position to get married? I don't know. Will you promise me to stay on the public road with this girl in future? Yes, Father. Yes, Father. I kept my promise, but she had other ideas and soon found somebody who was willing to go so far into the wood with her that they could come out the other side and left me chewing the bushes on the roadside. The crowd leapt the crossroads, pitch and toss schools started outside the pubs, and before very long, being a man meant to be able to take a few pints and use dirty language. The girls were allowed to attend morning mass, evening devotions, then the family rosary, and so to bed. If they were seen on the road, even in daylight with a boy, there were hints in a sermon on the following Sunday. In less than a year, at least 9 local girls had joined religious orders, 15 had left for England. Now, I mean, that's a sort of, there's humour in that story, but there's also a great kind of sadness in it, of the grip and the control, and this business of company keeping being a sin. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing attempt at controlling the sexual relations between boy and girl, and indeed between man and woman, as we can see. John Kelleher has an article in this as well. John Kelleher was an Irishman. Well, I say he was an Irishman. He was actually an Irish-American, but as 8 of his great-grandparents were Irish, I think we can call him an Irishman. And he was a professor of Irish studies in Harvard. He taught himself the Irish language. He lectured on archaeology, on history, on literature, and on poetry. And he was a really astonishing figure. And he was, when he came to Ireland, he was a friend of Sean O'Fuaylon and Frank O'Connor. But he's a piece in Foreign Relations, which is, I remember reading it when I was a student in Trinity, and I had a habit of browsing, of just taking a time off and just going to a shelf that I didn't know which shelf, what subject it was really, and just opening a book and just any old page and just reading. And you'd be surprised what you bump into. That was much more possible in those days. Now things tend to be kept away in the stacks, and unless you have the call number, you've got to call it out from there. And so it was much easier to browse on open shelving. And I'm a great believer in that. Anyway, Kelleher had this article in Foreign Affairs in 1957. And it's a marvelous article. It's called Ireland and How Does She Stand? And of course, the echo he's looking for is, and how is dear old Ireland and how does she stand? He doesn't say she's the most distressful country, but that's what's in his head. He talks about Irish exporters, for instance, at the time. They want to export to America, but they want to know the price and quantity they'll sell for years to come. They want to know next year's designs and just what their competitors' costs are, and this in the highly volatile and conscious and risk-conscious American market. And how is that for vigor, daring, and imagination, asks Kelleher. He believed that Irish ills were largely psychosomatic, and he said the truth is that Ireland, far from being a country which had a distressing history, has had an almost fatally easy time of it in the 20th century. And I would think that that's true. If you look at the geographical size of Ireland and think of anywhere else in Europe, our 20th century is a terribly innocent experience. But we managed to combine that with the notion that we were hard done by all the time. And we were tops in self-deception and tops in agreed hypocrisies. And to some extent, we still are. Now, one other point I'd just like to make about the book before sitting with Patrick, and that is that I tried to use original documents as far as possible. At one stage, I was going to attempt to try and do the entire anthology from original documents, by which I mean diaries and letters, and writings that were perhaps had a frankness because they were intended not for publication, but might have had a function, of course, within government or whatever, but were not written for publication. But that proved kind of impossible. So half the documents would be from published sources, and about half would be original diaries and letters. The 1916-23 period was also a challenge because it was so busy and so many things happened to us. So if you look at a timeline of Ireland between 1916 and 2016, obviously those 7 years, which passed as quickly, by the way, we tend to think, if you think of the periodization of those 7 years, you can come up with any number of periods, but some of them were quite short between the truce and the treaty talks, for instance, and the treaty period, the Civil War. These must have rushed by as any 6 months rushes by in all our lives. But I tend to think of them as being slow. And another way of looking at that was between 1951 and 1920, 51 was the mother and child scheme, 1921 was the treaty. That was just 30 years. And that went by as quickly as the last 30 years in our lives, between 1986 now, say the Good Friday Agreement and now. And we know how we remember the Good Friday, not the Good Friday Agreement, sorry, the Hillsborough Agreement in 1985 and now. That's 30 years. So the treaty to the mother and child scheme was also 30 years. And I think that's a question of imagination. Anyway, I wanted to talk also about, one other document which I was delighted to find and which I think is quite an interesting one and gives some idea of the scale of things, is a report by Deputy Governor G. Macfarlane on Brendan Behan when he was in Borstal. And the Borstal he was in was based actually on an English public school. It had houses. It was trying to inculcate some of the values of the sort of loyalty to the house in football matches between the boys and so on. And Macfarlane impressed me hugely by his insight into Behan. He said he was above the average in intelligence and facility of tongue, very popular with the other colonists. They were known as colonists. His mind is lively. He enjoys juggling with words and ideas, quite undeterred by being snubbed. Challenge him to stop foolish talking and get down to serious thinking. He can do it to good account. He loves the limelight. Whilst playing to the gallery, he's not unmindful of the stalls. And he was trying to compensate for a feeling of insecurity. And he was impressed that Macfarlane was impressed that Behan had insight into this condition. He described him as a passionate nationalist. He states his sympathies are all on the side of Britain. This was during World War II at the moment. And of course, Behan was there because he'd attempted to be part of an IRA bombing campaign at just 1939, at the eve of the war. Because Behan says Britain is fighting to defend principles in which he wholeheartedly believes. He considers he was in error in joining the bombing plan of the IRA and says that he does not intend to engage in such activities again. And Behan believed that the leniency shown him has made a good impression on him. Well, he was released, he returned to Dublin, but he rejoined the IRA and was convicted of attempted murder of two detectives. But the picture of Behan there, I think, as the sort of 15-year-old is very telling and quite well observed. So they were the sort of documents I was looking for. And there are many, many more, of course, in the book. And I'll now stop and I'll sit down.
Okay, well, John, we might begin with a question about 1916, because the book begins with a number of pieces about the Rising. You have Elizabeth Bone in the Shelburne Hotel. You have Patrick Pearse's last letter to his mother, Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, on the death of Francis. You also have 1916 closing the book with a very nice piece by John A. Murphy on the recent centenary commemoration. And then 1916 also appears with some pieces on the 50th anniversary. So how did you go about selecting those pieces, and why did you decide to frame the book using 1916?
If you wanted to really want to know the truth on this, the fact that the book was running late, so I decided, look, let's run it late, let's run it up to Easter 2016, let's end with that, and then call it the century, because truthfully, you could have a book, as you know, you could have a book 50 times this length, I won't say equally good pieces, and I think the pieces chosen are quite good, and some of them are small in the sense that they look unimportant, but they're actually chosen. I mean, like the exchange between Kavanagh and his confessor, that's kind of got a humorous side, but it's also got a profoundly sad side to it because of the extent to which
that was part of Ireland in the 40s and 50s, particularly 30s, 40s, 50s. It was astonishing. But no, to come back to your question, the actual reason was that we decided to just take that century, 1916 to 2016, because I knew we were going to just finish the work around this period, and it seemed a logical idea.
Very good. You mentioned 170 pieces.
Yeah.
There is a very good balance between male and female contributors. Was that something you were conscious about?
Not particularly. I don't believe that we should be totally driven by gender. I'm always driven by the quality of the piece, and then I might look at that later, but I don't like to be, there's a sort of tyranny sometimes of trying to make things sort of 50-50 or something, which I think, and there's also a lot of material in it. I mean, for instance, Kavanagh is actually talking in that piece that I read, that's about women as much as men. So I would consider that kind of gender, I'd be gender blind on Kavanagh. I wouldn't care whether it was a woman reporting that particular experience or a man. I wouldn't be counting that as by a woman or a man particularly.
There is a very good piece by Hannah Shee Skeffington in 1943. I think the headline of it is, Why Will Women Not Vote for a Woman? And she was running for election, and you even get a sense from that and some of the other pieces about the changing role of women in society.
Yes, and the fact that it wasn't changing, because the only women in the Dáil in the 1940s were all widows or daughters. And that was always, that remained true until kind of quite recently, about the last 30 years. But will women not vote for a woman? I mean, I think the feminist position ought to be to vote for a feminist, and whether male or female. I don't think that the female candidate on any ticket is necessarily the most feminist candidate. Our current president, for instance, is a feminist and always has been a feminist. That's just one example. Hannah Shee Skeffington would have only got about 1,000 votes in that election. She had no chance of winning. She wasn't getting much attention from the newspapers either, which she was complaining about. But then she was running in a constituency where there were some very dominant figures already. And by the way, with our current new rules about 30% of one gender on any ticket, which is the ticket now that runs, that means that nobody could now form a women's party. Now, you might say this is an argument that there might be a women's party in Ireland, but you actually now couldn't form it. Well, you'd have to find an awful lot of men to stand, presumably hopeless men who couldn't win, that you'd have to put on your ticket if you wanted to enjoy the... I'm just making that as a point that the tyranny of gender can work in many different ways.
Not every...
So it's a temporary necessity, perhaps, the situation where I have it at the moment.
Not every document in it is a published document. Some are private memoranda. One of my favourite ones was from he was the editor of the Irish Press, Frank Gallagher, and it was his notes for how he wanted things to be covered in the Irish Press. This was 1931. So, for example, you were never to refer to Northern Ireland, or Ulster, it was the six counties. And you should always try and put Ireland first in the story. So even if it was an international story, you should put in the Irish dimension. And you still see that in a later piece, when they have, there's a piece about John F. Kennedy's visit here in 1963, and it has a report from the Irish Press, and the Irish Press references Kennedy's famous visit to Berlin, where they point out, and didn't it all bring home, you know, how terrible partition was? And so the Irish Press clearly took his advice to heart.
They took his advice to heart, but he didn't practice what he preached, because one of the things he was preaching was be on your guard against the habits of British and foreign news agencies who look on the world mainly through imperialist eyes. For instance, do not pass the word bandits as a description of South American revolutionaries. And pirates and robbers in China are not necessarily communists and so on. But in his own paper, and it's actually, as it happens, the next document in the book, he was looking at the world through kind of quite Catholic eyes. And how I found this particular document, I actually spent an awfully long time looking for it, because I got the date wrong in the diary entry of my initial clue. And because I had that date wrong, I was then looking at the wrong issue of the Irish Press to find the offending article. The article had offended Rosamond Jacob, who was a De Valera supporter, very, very interesting woman. Also, by the way, very interested in dancing. The reason I know that is that I read through her diaries. Her diaries are quite long-winded, and her writing is quite good, but there's a very, very lengthy diaries, and all her picnics in Killiney and her Cayley dancing in the Mansion House, hoping to get a good dancer. She's desperate to get a good man who's able to dance, and none of them can dance anyway. But that's, by the way. But I found this particular comment that she made. On it was actually Monday, 7th of December, 1931, but I had it down as an earlier part of the end of November, which is why I was being led astray when I looked for the Irish Press. But she says, and this was the day the Irish Press came out with a thick type paragraph on the front page denouncing the Buckmaster article on birth control. When I finally found the article on birth control in the Irish Press, because it was on December the 7th, and this was only 10 weeks after the Irish Press started publishing. The Irish Press was a very, very important newspaper. It changed the whole way in which newspapers in Ireland reported politics and reported many other things. It changed the way they reported the GAA, for instance. They gave room to Gaelic games, which didn't get nearly enough coverage up to that point. And by the way, they also had news on the front page. Up to the 50s, or if not the 60s, the Irish Independent, the Irish Times, had small ads on the front page. Their page one was actually the centrefold, because that was the last page on the sort of printing presses that they were using, that they could put the latest news. That was true of the London Times as well. But the Irish Press had bought an American printer, printing system. So they had news on the front page, which was really mega in terms of marketing. You could imagine the impact it was making. But anyway, back to Rosamund Jacob. And in the article in the Irish Press, and this is where I'm making the point that Gallagher, who's the first editor, a brilliant editor, by the way, he was asking his own journalists not to look at the world through imperialist press association eyes, but he's looking at the world through Catholic eyes. In yesterday's issue, he says, of the Sunday Times, the principal article was one headed Birth Control, written by Lord Buckmaster, and as its title implies, it dealt with the unnatural prevention of conception and blatantly advocated a course of action and a manner of married life repulsive to every Christian. The article was an extraordinary exhibition of how far paganism and animalism had gone in England, when one of the most conservative organs stars an affront to the Christian basis of life, which must disgust every decent heart in Britain. Well, now, Rosamund Jacob saw this, and she writes in her diary, this was the day the Irish Press came out with a thick type paragraph on the front page denouncing the Buckmaster article on birth control, and showing the depth of paganism, as the Irish Press said, and animalism disgusting to every decent heart in Britain, in England. I visited Dorothy, that would be Dorothy McCardle, who is another De Valera supporter, another Fianna Fáil supporter, another Irish Press reader, and the author of The Irish Republic, which she was commissioned by De Valera to write. I visited Dorothy McCardle that evening, and she was raging over it, the arrogant rudeness to all non-Catholics, the ignorance of it, let alone the devilishness of the church attitude. She was very downhearted over the paper altogether, with the sectarian blight over it and Fianna Fáil and the country. Never heard anyone speak better. Like me, she had got the Sunday Times and thought the article excellent. Now, that it's interesting that this is confided to a diary. She didn't write a letter to the Irish Press because she knew it wouldn't be published. And that's another example, I think, of where the printed word and the confidential note in the diary is so telling. And again, if you think of 1931, it's interesting that there were such modern women in Fianna Fáil and in reading the Irish Press at the time, but they didn't have the prospect of emerging.
Keeping with the theme of religion, one of my favorite pieces is from 1948, and it was a regular column in the Irish Messenger magazine that some of you might remember. And you would write in for the column, which was, is it a sin? So one of the questions that apparently was a regular question was, is it a sin to pray that you'll win the sweepstakes? And the answer is that, well, it's not wrong to pray, but on the other hand, you have to be careful you don't ruin your soul if you do win. And that's why it's good to pray, because if you are going to ruin your soul, then you won't win, because God will make sure that you won't get hurt in that way. Or another good one is, can you pray while cycling or working? And, you know, obviously an important point says, well, there's not really a problem with that, but it's preferable to do it at home on your knees and don't make a habit of it.
Yeah, well, you're a little bit unfair to the messenger. The title was The Question Box, but most of the letters did begin with, is it a sin? Okay. Now, I then gave this particular document, it's not quite a chapter, it's only two or three pages, but I gave it that title, but it was called The Question Box. Is it a sin for a girl to improve her looks by using cosmetics, lipstick, etc.? No, it is not a sin, says the Jesuit. It's a fairly harmless vanity. It is, however, a sign of the times, of the lessening of female modesty, which is too much a characteristic of nowadays. The universality of it is not an encouraging sign. We would be better without it and maybe better looking, many of us. Who is the patron saint of motor mechanics? Is anger a mortal sin? Is it a sinful to open and read another person's letters? It most certainly is. And so on. Anyway.
Very good. And it ties into another piece that is another of my favourites. This is a few years earlier. This is 1928, and it's an Irish Times report on a Lenten sermon delivered by a Jesuit in Dublin. And it has wonderful advice to women on marriage and how to keep their husband away from the triple threat of golf, girls, and Guinness. The best way is make the home clean and neat and comfortable. If girls knew as much about cooking as they did of the different ways of doing up their hair and powdering their noses, there would not be so many marriage failures. I tried to read that to my wife at home, but I didn't get far. Religion is something that the book, you can, the pieces are arranged chronologically, but you can see the themes develop. Religion is one of them, changing nature of society. Northern Ireland becomes one of them. That it's very interesting when you kind of look at these thematically.
Yes, well, every reader will presumably find their own sequence, and they'll find their own points where there's an echo for them, or that's important for them. I'm only selecting, I suppose, as I've said before, one could make a very different selection, and perhaps people will see a bias from me in the selection that I've chosen, and that could well be the case. One of the themes that I certainly I found was just the theme of censorship, thou shalt not. That really is quite a big theme in a lot of the advice and a lot of the education and the politics and church and state. Thou shalt, I mean, you probably don't, this is not in the book, but the film censorship is in the book quite a bit, but when The Quiet Man was censored, the offending words that were cut out was John Wayne, or somebody saying to John Wayne, gosh, a man would need to be quite a sprinter to catch his wife in a bed this big. And this was solemnly snipped out, lest it lead the whole country astray. That was 1951. And this was a major film, which of course became an absolute classic, and was seen all over the world. So we were reduced to protecting. And with protectionism in Ireland, some of you, of course, I can see from the audience, are old enough to almost just remember it. But the rest of you have no idea what you escaped. It really, and you know, one of the big things that changed was the arrival of television. And it wasn't what kind of Telefiche Aaron or what RTE did. It was the oxygen of the medium itself. Now, it was what they did with that, but above all, it was the oxygen, because there were so many sort of hypocrisies at the heart of Irish life, and you cannot put oxygen. Badgett said, didn't he, about the monarchy, don't let daylight in on magic. So he believed the monarchy might not survive if you started explaining it, because, of course, you couldn't justify it. It's a total nonsensical idea that the eldest male child of any two people would necessarily be the head of state of any place. It was just childish, in my view. But it has prevailed and survived, and oddly enough, prevailed in the most democratic countries in Europe and in all the rest of Europe, which didn't do that well in keeping fascism and other things away. Monarchy was overthrown. But anyway, I'm just making the point. Letting daylight in on magic. There was an awful lot of magicians in Ireland in the 1930s. And they're in this book. They're priests and they're politicians and they're hypocrites, many of them. But once the daylight comes in, they don't prosper. And I think television was part of the daylight. And feminism was as well, of course.
And there's a great piece by Colm Tobin on the Late Late Show and the impact it had. You mentioned there how everyone would have their own ideas of what they'd like to see included. The one that I would have included was, you have great pieces about the actual Civil War, but not the great sporting Civil War of recent years, Roy Keane, Mick McCarthy, and Saipan. And I'm wondering why there wasn't an extract from that.
Well, I did look at that and some of the coverage of that. And what I found missing, the reason I think the answer to your question is there's a lot of things not in the book. But the reason I think that's not in the book is that I think the key question was not asked on that occasion. I mean, Roy Keane was exhaustively interviewed, etc., after what he'd said. But I think there was one question that was not asked, and that was, while holding to your original analysis and your criticism of the arrangements for this, would you apologize for the manner in which you expressed those reservations? That would have given Roy Keane the space to maintain his complaint, which was mega, but to just apologize for the savage language which he had used to express it. And I never heard that question asked. So had that been asked, that would have made it to the book, but it wasn't asked.
Very good. And of course, we never got a transcript of what was actually said either, which would have helped. And taking the book up to more recent times then, you have the whole property bubble and a great piece by Morgan Kelly. It's even on the back cover. This is a classic bubble. It's going to end in tears, no question about it, which of course prompted Bertie Ahern to suggest that all these pessimists should... do themselves in, and you also have a prediction about the trouble that water would cause Irish politicians.
Yeah. Well, it is, as you said, it is up to late last night, and the John A. Murphy piece, of course, is about the commemoration. It was written just after Easter Sunday of 2016. So the book does cover, it covers Ryanair, it covers all sorts of experiences. I liked the Ryanair piece. I managed to avoid Ryanair quite a bit myself. I prefer the other airline. I just do. Perhaps it's that the air stewards know me, and the Ryanair people don't know who I am. There's your man from the telly or something. the Aer Lingus people know me anyway. So it is an attempt to bring the story right up to late last night. But the other point that I would make is that I hope it will appeal to people. Because it could be in a dentist's waiting room and you could read four pieces while you're... Because it is genuinely referenced. Now, the next point I'm not the best judge of, because it certainly will more appeal to Irish readers who kind of have a fair gist of the story. But it's very hard to get the balance right between how much context do you put in to the introducing a text. It's quite difficult, because if you start really giving it the full treatment... then the introduction can be longer than the text. And I suppose you also hope that as people read on from the beginning, if they read it through, and some people I've been talking to me have done that, then obviously they're picking up some of the context that will be relevant at a later point where a fresh document appears. Other than that, it is very difficult, if you're Irish and you know the story, to just get that thing right of how much detail does a piece need before it starts. And I always think, when I'm writing Irish history, I always think of my New Zealand readers, all seven of them, because I've had occasion sometimes to read New Zealand's history just for reasons of, say, the 1926 Imperial Conference or something. I want to know who were the New Zealand players and so on. And you pick up these books and you really kind of, you're not introduced properly to them. And so I think it's quite an important thing to let people know in as few words as possible, without being condescending to the people who do know the story and do know the context, to introduce the documents that way.
Very good. Okay, we'll take some questions in a minute, but a final question from me. There isn't an index to the book, and the full dates for each piece and the references of where they're from are at the end. Was that a deliberate decision by you or the publisher?
That was a style point by the publisher. I would be happier with the provenance of any piece being where it starts, because the date, the exact date, say in 1921, is important. The exact date is, of course, there. It's in the reference. So I would encourage people when they're reading the book to look up the back notes. That's what I do when I'm reading. I'm afraid I'm always going back to the end notes at the back. And I really wish publishers doesn't relate to this because it's somewhat different. But yeah. I love that new technique where you're given the footnotes by number and then reference to page 207 to 239. And you can read them pretty. Otherwise, you're going backwards and forwards. Which chapter is this? So it's a small change. But
yeah. What I found brilliant reading it was that as each piece you go through, you get a sense of Ireland changing, Northern Ireland changing, the troubles are dealt with. And you know, towards the end of the book, there is a piece by Fintan O'Toole on the marriage referendum last year. And when you read it, a few hours after you were reading the sermon from the priest in 1928 about girls in Guinness and golf, and you think that only about 90 years has gone by, but Ireland has changed completely, it really actually shocks you, kind of, and you think, you don't really believe that it's an autobiography of 100 years, you actually think it's 200 years or 300 years of history being covered in it. And the point that John made about the 30-year period, you know, the way it seems longer than it actually is. It really brings home that point to you very strongly.
Now, I'll give you an example on contraception. Contraception, which is again one of the themes, it echoes from Bernard Shaw up to the Irish Press Rosamund Jacob piece to much later into the contraceptive train and so on. But the evidence on contraception is that the change happened, you can see it in the 1971 census, by the date of birth of the firstborn after marriage. You can see that we were making medical history by the number of women who were on the pill, which had just recently become available, as a cycle regulator. We had the most irregular cycles. not in the Western world, in the world anywhere. We were tops in irregularity when it came to females and cycles. But they were all had the agreed hypocrisy with their gynecologist if they could sort it. And of course that applied more to middle class women because they had doctors who would do it for them. But all of that is over now. I remember the Barry O'Donnell, who was the president, he was actually the president of the Irish Medical Association, the British Medical Association, and the Canadian Medical Association in the 1 year. He's the most distinguished pediatrician. And he said to me in 1975, live on air, he said, we need a debate on contraception, on family planning. And the pen fell out of my hand. I said, the debate is over. You know, this is the most exhaustive debate. He was so busy being a pediatrician, or else I think now, that's the way I thought at the time, I now think he was trying to catch up, that history had changed, and the doctors and the pediatricians, the gynecologists, were behind the curve, and the curve had moved, and the women were on the curve. And it was women, because the people determining policy at that time were doctors, bishops, lawyers, and politicians, all middle-aged men with their families already born, if they except the bishops, of course, but with one exception, which is also in the book, by the way. It's a very, very good piece. But, I mean, he's not a hypocrite. He's a hypocrite, but he's not an abuser. I always think it's very, very, very unfair to lump him in with sexual abuse, because this was consenting adults in private, and that's another matter. That's a totally different matter. But he was a hypocrite as far as he was still preaching the other stuff. But anyway, to come back just to that, in the decade of the 1970s alone, on television, contraception was being discussed in 1970. Is it a sin? Next, is it a crime? And before the end of the 1970s, surely it's a civil right. Now, that is modernization at a speed. That tells you the speed. They were the questions within the decade of the 1970s alone, how that subject moved. And, of course, women were driving that subject.
Okay, well, I think that's a very good note on which to end our discussion today. I think we would have to put on record our thanks to Bert Reich and the organisers of this Dublin Festival of History. I think it goes from strength to strength every year. And despite rain, despite whatever bus strikes are happening, despite irregular fire alarms, we still come out for the events. And I think the organisers have done another brilliant job this year.
Thank you for listening to this Dublin Festival of History podcast, brought to you by Dublin City Council. To hear more, please subscribe on iTunes or SoundCloud. You can also follow us on Twitter or visit our website, dublinfestivalofhistory.ie, where you can sign up for our newsletter.